Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Today we're going to give you a couple of different snapshots of the coronavirus pandemic. My first interview is going to be with Dr. Daniela Lamas, who's a critical care doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. She's been on Medical Monday before. She wrote a book about people who come out of the critical care unit and what that's like, called You Can Stop Humming Now. She is practicing there at the Medical Intensive Care Unit at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She's also a contributor to the New York Times, frequently writing essays, two of which we'll talk about. One, her lamentation about families being excluded from the ICU. Her more recent piece on April 2nd was about what's going to happen if she has to decide which patients get ventilators and which cannot by simple lack of supply. I want to remind you, right now, in Boston at least, there is no shortage of ventilators. That's the good news. And in terms of orders of magnitude, there are 300,000 cases as we tape here on Saturday afternoon to practice safe social distancing. 300,000 in the United States, 100,000 in New York, only 10,000 in Boston, and about 1,000 here in Oklahoma. The second part of the show, we're going to talk to Dr. Jibran Pasha, a local physician. He's a faculty member at the OUTU School of Community Medicine, where he's the director of student recruitment, also the associate program director for the residency program. And Dr. Pasha practices as a hospitalist. He also is serving a term as chapter president of the Tulsa American Heart Association. And we'll talk a little bit about the impact of the epidemic on the Heart Association and other nonprofits. But he also gives us an overview of local hospitals and what they're doing to prepare for the presumed upsurge that's going to occur. So, update on the coronavirus, both from Boston, Massachusetts, and here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with my guests today. First, you'll hear Dr. Daniela Lamas, and second, Dr. Jibran Pasha. Dr. Daniela Lamas, welcome back to Medical Monday. Let's just start by asking how you're holding up.
Thank you. I'm holding up all right here in Boston. Given that we're so near New York, we watch that on television and news, and a lot of us either have trained there or have friends there, and so you know, what's going on here feels smaller in contrast, and it is. That being said, for each individual who gets sick and for each time you are taking care of a COVID-positive patient, you know, that fear for that person, their family, doesn't feel small. It's 100% for them. And so, you know, I think we're in that and kind of aware of both of those feelings. So clearly I'm conflicted. There's like an anxiety of what's to come, of what more we could be doing, but I think that's kind of like where we're living in Boston right now.
Well, so what's your daily life like, I guess, when you're in the unit or working in critical care?
Yeah, so I've been in the medical ICU for a lot of March, been off for a couple of days now since it became April, and was there when we started first getting patients with COVID and kind of figuring out our protocols and our ways to, you know, both treat them and be careful about that while also kind of keeping ourselves and our staff safe. And so that's kind of been hard. You know, I was there when we decided to make the decision to run the hospital, not we, I was not part of this, but when the hospital decided to keep all families out of the hospital, both for families of COVID-positive patients and not. And that was also and has been a hard and sort of odd transition.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the pieces that you wrote recently published in the New York Times where you're a contributor. It was titled, I'm on the Front Lines, I Have No Plan for This. And actually, I was wondering if you probably don't have, do you have it in front of you by any chance? No.
I can momentarily because I have a computer in front of me.
Yeah, pull it up. And I was hoping you could read to us the two paragraphs starting, So It's Up to Us.
So it's up to us, the healthcare workers who are seeing these patients at the front lines, to find ways to maintain connection, to balance our fear with tenderness. This won't be easy. I think of myself as the kind of doctor who sits at a bedside, who holds a hand, who explains what is going on slowly and gently, even to my intubated patients, because I can't know what they will remember. I want to be the doctor who is always willing to spend a few extra minutes despite being stressed or rushed. But that's not the kind of doctor I've been for the past few weeks, because I don't want to spend a moment longer in a COVID-19 patient's room than I have to. Even with a mask firmly in place, even with a gown and eye protection, I do not want to share the same air. So I do what I need to do, and then I leave. I don't take the time to reassure, to explain, surely not to hold a hand. Truth is, I'm scared.
Yeah, I thought that was so evocative. And in that piece, you went on to talk about a patient who was on a ventilator through a trach, and you told the patient's husband to say goodbye. I mean, you said you can't come back. And so your unit and the doctors and nurses there have had to adapt to these virtual visits, FaceTime and all kinds of things. And I mean, I imagine that's been incredibly challenging to your workflow. So what's it like working in a unit where there's no guests, no family members?
Yeah. You know, there was this part of me, a silly part of me, that thought that the unit would be kind of quieter and more efficient without people. Entirely untrue. The families are a real key part, and anybody who's been a family member of a critical care patient probably thinks that what I just said was awful. But it turns out, you know, and I think I did know this, that the families are such an important part of the unit. We had become used to having family members present on rounds, not for all the patients, but obviously just for their loved ones. And so they would stand there and listen to the intern's daily recording of what the overnight events were and going through the labs and the imaging. And they would observe that we were kind of dealing with every issue that their loved one had. We were being really careful. And, you know, we were trying, and they could see that we were trying. And also, we could learn from them about their loved ones. For better or worse, in the sort of era of handoffs and people working nights and days and 2 weeks at a stretch or one weekend off, families are often the only continuity. That person at the bedside is the best continuity that somebody has. And without that, and without the kind of introduction that a family offers into who is this intubated and sedated person, it's very lonely and weird, and in a way, it risks critical care has a high potential to be dehumanizing, right? And without a family there at the bedside, I think that risk is much more real than it used to be. And so we do what we can. You know, to your question, we do what we can, which means we call families. We stuck an iPhone on speakerphone with a adult son and daughter conference in the other day next to an intubated man's ear, and you know, they hollered at him, "I love you, Dad. I love you, Dad." And it seemed like he heard them. We told him that he did. You know, so there are moments like that, but everybody is suffering. You know, the patients, to whatever extent they're awake, are very lonely. And the families on the other end of the line, somewhere there in Boston or other, you know, somewhere else, quarantined on their own, afraid, they're suffering too. And so I think that is, to me, as I observed it kind of being rolled out and shifting, and now it's something that, you know, so many people are writing about, it really is a big part of the way in which this virus causes suffering, is because of the isolation that is a necessity.
Yeah, I'm just kind of haunted by your writing about the part where you say, you know, you don't want to breathe an extra second of the air in that COVID-19 room. I mean, it's just because normally you'd want to be there. You'd want to be at the bedside touching the individual and trying to offer empathy. And like, you know, all the right things to do here are, you know, minimize contact as much as totally possible. Your most recent piece, which just came out, is they gave it the title, "What If We Have to Decide Who Gets a Ventilator?" And I like that piece too, because you were writing about, you were sort of caught unaware where there was a patient in the unit who did not have COVID, as far as I understood, who was a cancer patient who had been suffering. And I think the husband called, maybe I have it backwards, but called to essentially plead and say, hey, she was still, you know, holding video conferences, or she was still a vital individual, even though she has advanced cancer, still living a meaningful life. So please, you're not going to take her off the ventilator, are you? And what you realized kind of in quick reflection was that he was panicked that you were going to have to ration care and essentially take away this woman's ventilator, so, you know, ultimately consigning her to death because of the critical need. Well, fortunately, you weren't at that critical decision point, but it allowed you to at least reflect on it. I guess that you have a lot of colleagues in New York where you did fellowship training. Is that happening there?
I don't know to what extent it is happening there in any sort of early way, but, you know, to my understanding, it has not officially started happening there. But the worries are real and present, and, you know, based on a legitimate fear that if they don't get more supplies, they will not have enough ventilators to be able to offer the number of patients with coronavirus who might need them. the time for their lungs to heal. You know, so I think we're seeing sort of more and more in the press about this, and I think it is frightening. I think that it's not reassuring, but what I kind of tried to say and what I've learned is that, you know, these are standards that generally try to make sure that an individual clinician at the bedside, you know, like me working overnight, I am not making these decisions. You know, these decisions are often or proposed to be separated from the doctor who's seeing the patient. I don't know if that's better or worse necessarily, but it's based on a set of criteria that are understood broadly and have been agreed upon, not based on an individual clinician's judgment at the bedside. And I think that this is somewhere that we have never been before. And I think it's scary and sad and feels wrong. It feels like something that should not be. It feels like that having to make these decisions based on the shortage of a piece of equipment doesn't feel right. I think, you know, increasingly we are trying our best to get our heads around what it would mean if we really have to do this.
So I was reviewing some of the numbers before we came on, and it, you know, New York really is the epicenter right now. I mean, there's over 100,000 cases. It looks like, you know, there's an order of magnitude. So Massachusetts has about 10,000 cases in the state,
mm-hmm.
and most of that is in the metropolitan area, so near you. But I'm gathering it that the wave has not hit you yet. What are you foreseeing, or what are your experts telling your fellow experts telling you to anticipate in the week or 2 weeks or even longer ahead?
Right, we're being told that we're sort of being staffed and told to expect that we could anticipate anything up to, you know, 100-150 ICU patients who are sick enough to need mechanical ventilation. It's, you know, you hear those numbers, it's hard to imagine because we're really not there yet. We have something like 35 COVID ICU patients right now, which feels very small. I mean, there's hospitals in New York, hearing from a friend that one hospital has about 150 ventilated COVID patients right now. So clearly it's very small comparatively, but we're kind of preparing. We're preparing to have many more. And just seeing, you know, based on taking care of a couple of these patients, seeing the intense amount of resources that caring for these people take, particularly on the front end when they come in, that's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine. You know, there's getting into the room takes the entire donning PPE. Often these patients are sick enough so that they need not constant but frequent titration of the ventilator. Often, and particularly in COVID, they benefit from proning, so a maneuver where they're actually placed on their sort of belly and chest rather than lying on their back, which takes nurses to turn them over carefully with a respiratory therapist holding the tube to make sure that they're not, you know, accidentally extubated while being turned. So they're labor intensive to be able to give them the best shot possible. And so to think about, you know, amplifying that tenfold, you know, in some hospitals, that's very hard to imagine. We're trying our best to be prepared. And I think, you know, part of that might be having our hospital working sort of broader within Boston as a health system, because there's some hospitals that have started surging more than we have. So trying to make sure that patients are kind of dispersed equally among hospitals, I think I'm told might be something that helps.
Well, Daniela Lamas, it's great to talk to you again, and your writing has been magnificent, and just your reflections on what you're going through as this pandemic continues to overtake the whole world and the United States. And I wish you nothing but the best, and please stay safe. You are right in the thick of it.
Yes. Well, I hope you you and your family and everybody in Tulsa stays safe as well.
You just heard my interview with Dr. Daniela Lamas, a critical care doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Now we turn to an interview with Dr. Jibran Pasha, who is an internal medicine physician. He practices hospital medicine. He is a hospitalist here in Tulsa. He is also the director of student recruitment and the associate residency program director at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. Well, Dr. Jibran Pasha, welcome back to Medical Monday. How are you doing?
John, you know, I'm doing well, all things considered. It really took me, like many of us, some time to kind of adjust to this situation. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was kind of starting to feel the burden of it a little bit. And I think appreciating that you can't be consumed with this information too much was helpful for me. And so, you know, not sitting at home watching the updates so much, not spending so much time covered up with this stuff has helped me. And also just having a better understanding of what lies ahead and what is actually going on has helped me personally kind of cope with it. Because when, you know, when there's such a degree of uncertainty, it's a lot more stressful. And now that we are starting to know a lot more about COVID-19, it has helped me start to deal with it a bit better.
Yeah. So where do you see it going? I mean, I know there's lots of predictions and modeling that's used for when we think peak time will be, both nationally or here in Oklahoma. But what, how are you calling it at this point?
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, there's a lot of models and predictions out there, and those are really based off of a lot of assumptions. And it just makes it really difficult to predict. But if we kind of take the belief that at least here locally, we are a couple of weeks behind some of the other states here in the country, I think that can kind of at least help you predict what things are going to be like in the near future. And so, you know, just kind of looking back on where we were as a country 2 weeks ago, we had about 20,000 cases 2 weeks ago. And as you know, today we've crossed 300,000. And so that's a 15x increase in 2 weeks. And so, you know, if you take that and just try to get a general idea, you know, we have 1,000 cases here in Tulsa right now. And if we are about 2 weeks behind, you know, we're going to be in the tens of thousands of cases in a couple of weeks. And so that is really going to be enough to put some sort of strain on our healthcare system. And so it is definitely concerning.
So you spend your clinical time as a hospitalist working in one of the Tulsa hospitals. Now, I've read some of your social media posts, which are very helpful. And I think you have a lot of interested readers who are people who work either in the university community, the healthcare community, or just the lay public, who find your posts very readable and very reassuring on a pretty, I guess, maybe Monday through Friday kind of basis. I don't know if you're doing it every day, but how do you feel the hospitals are doing in their preparations for this?
You know, I think really well. You know, I've got friends or colleagues kind of scattered across the healthcare system here in town, and we talk. And just kind of getting an idea of what everyone else is doing is helpful in terms of preparation. And I think most of the hospitals are really approaching it in similar ways. You know, limiting the usage of healthcare in general has been really important over the last few weeks. So, you know, canceling elective surgeries, really reducing the amount of people coming in through offices and for surgical procedures has really freed up staff, caretakers, and protective equipment. Also, just really understanding that we have not hit our peak, and that when we do hit our peak, we are going to need more ICUs. We are going to need different kinds of isolation rooms. We're going to need more negative pressure rooms for patients who do have COVID. And so most of the hospitals in town, if not all of the hospital systems in town, are really working to expand that capacity. The state has asked the hospital systems to expand their bed capacity by 40%, which means they're going to hopefully need to expand their staffing by 40% as well. And so finding creative ways to create more space has been something that the hospitals in town have been working to do. Finding ways to turn regular hospital rooms into ICU rooms and negative pressure rooms are also things that hospitals are starting to do, and making sure that we have enough ventilators. And obviously everyone knows that making sure that we have enough PPE, as we call it, protective equipment, for our staff and for our physicians is really a major priority. And that has obviously gotten a lot of attention across the country.
The things I've been reading seems like Oklahoma is doing a little bit better in terms of more personal protective equipment on hand. Is that your sense of things too?
Yeah, you know, at our healthcare system, at colleague systems, everyone seems to be pretty comfortable with where they are. And this does not at all mean that we're at a surplus and we're not concerned that there may be a need. But we are being really judicious with our use. Traditionally, you know, these N95 masks are made to be one-time use masks. And I think every system in town are really asking their staff to reuse them. And we're really trying to find safe but creative ways to make sure that is safe, and finding ways to actually sterilize them without really decreasing the effectiveness of them.
Now, you mentioned hospitals retooling, trying to find perhaps either fallow space that they can use for extra beds or taking non-critical care areas and converting them into either negative pressure rooms or critical care beds. Are you also considering, or the hospitals that, as far as you know, looking at these adjoining facilities or tents, you know, types of things we're seeing in New York City?
You know, I have yet to hear that that's in the immediate plan for any system in town. I would imagine that there are people that are kind of planning for that. But as of right now, I'm not aware. I do know that some systems are moving their triage areas outside because if you can kind of basically being outdoors is kind of like being in a negative pressure room. And so you can move your triage areas outside. You can kind of make contact with any potentially an infected patient prior to them coming into the building. It will provide a more safe approach for everyone in the building and the actual staff that are doing the triaging. But in terms of setting up different camps, I have yet to hear that's actively going on right now, but I'm sure people are planning for that if there's a need.
I do want to ask you, too, about you are an associate residency program director, which means that you're responsible for helping select and train resident physicians. This is the category of people who are have graduated medical school and are on their way to becoming fully fledged doctors and spend, you know, often 3 or more years in training, and you work very closely with them. So what's the impact been on them and of all this? I mean, I assume similar to what everyone is kind of going through, that it's in the healthcare world, but are there special aspects that you could share about what they're going through? And also including in the trainees are the students you work with.
Yeah, and I'll kind of start with the students. You know, we obviously care about the education of our students and our residents, but I think what's even more important is their safety and well-being. And so we really had to make a call pretty early on of what we were going to do with our students who are kind of in their clinical years, meaning they're in the hospitals and clinics, and what we should do in terms of trying to minimize their potential exposure. And like I said, you know, their education is really important, but the question we had to answer was, well, what risk were we willing to take to make sure that they get hands-on training in the hospital and clinics? And we just really decided as a university that it really wasn't worth the risk. And so we were able to get our students off of rotations several weeks ago and have moved to a virtual model like most education institutions have. And so although they're not having direct patient care, they are still getting virtual lectures and kind of have some independent study modules that they're completing. And so I think we just feel, at least right now with what's going on, we can put a temporary hold on that part of their education. In terms of the residents, it's a little bit different because residents are physicians. And so they're a really important part of the healthcare system. And if you remove all of the residents in town out of the equation, then the system really wouldn't be able to hold up without them. And so what we're doing, at least our program, is we're doing our best to minimize our residents' exposure as well. And so we did remove them off of what we deemed kind of all non-essential rotations, and we did reduce the sizes of our resident teams to try to decrease the amount of residents that could potentially be exposed. And I think most importantly, we have, at this moment, we are not allowing our residents to see any COVID-positive patients or patients who are highly suspicious for having COVID-19. Now, that does two things. One, it kind of helps decrease our residents' risk of picking up the disease, but it also actually helps conserve PPE because our resident teams are large, right? At any given time, we may have 7 or 8 people on a resident team, and if all of those physicians are putting on masks and gowns and gloves, that really chews up the supply pretty quickly. And so I think we were also helping to conserve our PPE by limiting our exposure to the residents as well.
I know that you, Dr. Jibran Pasha, are currently the chapter president of the Tulsa chapter, that is, of the American Heart Association, which is a, you know, obviously a nonprofit organization dedicated to research and advocacy around heart disease, which has long been the nation's number one killer. And I know that for several years you've put on an event that has raised money, and then there's, of course, the annual Heart Walk. How, and this is something that's a sort of a broader societal question, I mean, what's the impact that you can share with listeners about the American Heart Association, but also, you know, and I guess, and then we can generalize to the other nonprofits that rely so much on fundraising.
Yeah, yeah. I think just like all other businesses, nonprofits are affected when the economy is stricken with something like we're going through right now. And it's often kind of overlooked, you know, with all that's going on. It really has impacted our peak fundraising season. The Heart Walk in itself generates, you know, well over $1 million for our office here locally. And with that, having to move to a virtual format is going to significantly impact the amount of money that we can bring in to help our community here locally. And our event that I helped found 5 years ago, Heartfelt Night, was actually scheduled to be this evening. And so, it is important to recognize that a lot of these nonprofit groups are affected as well, and their impact on society is really significant. And so if they are having issues generating income, then the constituents that they help, which now more than any other time, are in a significant need. And so that impact really is spread out across the community.
Wow. Yeah, that just seems like unbearable, really, for so many of these nonprofits. It's an interesting, there was a demarcation between a lot of the galas, the typical kind of big hullabaloos that occurred, I think, in February, and then the ones for March or April. You know, it's just some managed to get their fundraisers in, you know, which is a huge part of their annual budgets. It's just kind of an interesting sort of arbitrary time in history. Well, Jibran Pasha, thank you so much for speaking with us, and I wish you nothing but the best. Stay safe and keep up the great work you're doing in the community for healthcare, for trainees, and for being a role model in healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely, and thanks for allowing me to come back on the show. And, you know, I think it's important that, if I may, it's important to mention to everyone the importance of really being very intentional in your social distancing. You know, and for those of us who really are supporting strict mandates on social distancing, I think it's important. And I am one of those people, but I think it's important for us to not minimize the financial impact that it's going to have. And it's easy to, if you zoom out and say, you know, well, the economy will recover, to kind of minimize that impact. But if you really zoom in and really think about the impact it's going to have on families, it makes it, it puts a little bit more bite to it. And I think it's important to recognize that. That being said, you know, as these numbers are thrown out, and I really try to keep everyone updated on the numbers. When you just look at them as numbers, it's easy to not grasp that these are lives that we're talking about. And yesterday we had 1,000 people in our country die from it. And so you just can't put a financial price on the livelihood of our country. And so I really just want to make a plea to people to really stay home as much as they can and practice safe habits, and we will get through it. You know, this is temporary. It's going to take a lot more time than we really would have hoped, but we'll get past it. But everyone's just going to have to do their part.
Well, Jibran, my friend, thank you so much, and stay safe, okay?
Thanks a lot, John. You too.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. Please stay safe out there, keep your distance, and do lots of hand washing. Thanks for listening.